Great. I'm just sitting down with Altair today, speaking over the phone. So just to get started, thanks so much for being here and agreeing to share part of your story with me today. We'd like to start by asking a little bit about how you first kind of connected with the gay community or started engaging in gay life.
That was back in, I've always been Manila in the Philippines. I've always been connected with my own sexuality. Like I knew already who I was attracted to or what I was attracted to and what I was willing to explore. I was an only child raised by middle class in a middle class family and attending private school, not just private school, but well, private schools there are run by Catholic religious organizations. Either they're by Franciscan nuns or Spanish-based, church, whatever. And so there's a lot of religion and guilt building in me. Although even with that, I was always somewhat, well, not somewhat, I'm always a rebel with regards to what was the norm. And so I would usually explore a lot of things by myself. And then I finally found a group of friends that shared the same ideals or fantasies or, so I got into a lot of shenanigans in Manila. And so when the opportunity came to study in Canada in 92, of course I took it. And then of course I said to myself, I'm going to explore a lot of Caucasian guys in Canada. So that was really, the beginning, and it just snowballed into something else. And also during that time in Manila, I was fresh out of high school and attending university. I was encouraged to take this job at the McDonald's right smack in the middle of the red light district. And so coming from a very protective school, high school of, religion. So of course my head would be turning like Linda Blair, every time I take the public transit when we because the route to the university I was going to had to pass the red light district. So it was just beckoning. It was beckoning and saying, you have to walk these streets at night. And so I did. And so I got this job at McDonald's, and then my cousin, who was one of the managers there, hired me. And of course, I had to attend school in the morning and then did the evening shifts. And believe it or not, McDonald's there had a staff room that had bunk beds, so you can close and then sleep there and then open again the next day.
Oh my.
That was I know, against labor laws here, of course, but it's Manila. So anyway, so I would say to my mom, I won't be sleeping here, but I will be sleeping at McDonald's. But then so that allowed me to get out and go to the red light district and immerse myself in that culture of, pimps, prostitutes, and all these dangerous people in Manila. And so, because I wanted to meet a Caucasian guy. And so that's what I did. I basically got involved into prostitution. Not because I needed the money, but because I wanted to meet Caucasian guys, and boy, did I meet them. And of course, I also discovered that I was into much older men. And so that's basically what the market was there. I mean, expats and tourists and, people on business trips. So it's not like, the people we see at 90210. All these Aaron Spelling, because I grew up watching all these Aaron Spelling produced drama and series. And so, I never found any Asian guys to be sexually attracted to. So that that's what affected me. My ideals were like these Caucasian guys, right? And so I met this guy who was from Berlin, and he was younger than my usual clientele, and so but we built a relationship from there, and he spent a whole like a year in Bangkok, and I wasn't sure, but I think I'm pretty sure now, actually, but that I contracted HIV in 89 because of my friend Freddie, who's a Facebook friend now, because what am I going to do? I mean, at least I don't want to burn bridges with him. If I wanted to go to Berlin, I could still stay at his place. This was back in 89, and I still communicate with him. Wow. So, yeah. Wow. So that's how I think I contracted it, but I wasn't sure then. And then some weird shit started happening to me. I think I contracted herpes simplex, and because it has like weird marks down my groin, and then it will disappear. And then I would start getting these hives, and then it was just, I knew there was something wrong, and then this opportunity to come to Canada came, and I thought to myself, well, here we go, I'm sure they're going to test for HIV there. And then they didn't, wasn't part of the health exam for people traveling. And so I thought it was, I was just assuming, and I guess they just tested for TB. And so I assumed that I was clean, or I shouldn't use the word clean now, it was HIV negative. So I had this idea that I was HIV negative when I moved to Canada until 95. And what had happened was it was a sick bet between me and my roommate, because my roommate was working at the Roost, it was a main drag, and well, it's the main gay bar in Edmonton, and he worked as a drag queen there. He was a part of the nightlife denizens, and so it was a sick bet, and let's go over there, and we shared this one-bedroom apartment, and he would always get lucky, I won't, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm the one who's probably going to be there, like, I have no doubts, and then negative. So that began the very complicated and multi-layered story that I had to deal with, and I also went through denial. I'm still going through some fallout from that, and that's how I think maybe why my life is so dysfunctional.
So
see, I told that ramble.
No, that's great. This is kind of what we want to do with this project, is have people tell their stories. So we definitely want to leave space for you to do that. When you were back in Manila, was there information about HIV back then?
Only what we'd hear peripherally. It wasn't such a big deal back then. I think the news outlets were... It's very, very sensationalized, and they're more about the corruption of the government and all the AIDS stuff. We hear it from, believe it or not, the first time I've heard about it was through watching the 700 Club with Pat. Well, you know, the 700 Club, right?
I'm not sure, actually.
Okay, it's a religious program, extremely right-wing, and Pat, I forget the last name. Anyways, they were showing about there was this thing that's going on with the homosexuals in the States. So they were showing all this, like, you know, gay pride marches and so forth, of course. And so I just thought, only white people get it. it's all there. It doesn't exist here. I had a very, 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 very limited or barely any knowledge or understanding about it, of course. And so, that's the first time I've heard it. And and wasn't really concerned about it until 88, 89, because that's when I got introduced into using condoms. And, oh yeah, did I tell you, my first John, first wasn't really a John. He picked me up off the bar, and then I wasn't really expecting money. He introduced me to a thing called frottage. I mean, imagine an 18-year-old, you know, finally getting hooked up with this fucking Caucasian daddy. And then I go straight to the cookies, and then he fucking flicks me off, and then tells me, "We says this is what we're gonna do." He's from Belgium. I don't know Belgian accent, but whatever. It's he was like, he's like, "This is what we're gonna do," and I was like, "What?" Well, I remember I was trembling. I was like, my knees were like jello because I was just so nervous, and I'm thinking, "Oh, I'm finally getting this." And my God, I mean, when he unzipped his pants, his Belgian hose popped out, and I've never seen anything so humongous, and I was just like straight nervous, and then he flicked me off. I mean, what the? And so he's like, "This is what we're gonna do. We're just gonna rub bodies." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" It was erotic, it was sexy, but it was boring as fuck. And then he started telling me about this and that and about HIV and this and that. And I'm just like, when is this night going to be over? And so I guess he sensed there was no passion for me. And so then the morning, when I was getting dressed to go back to school, and put on my school uniform, and this guy was like, "You know, you weren't so good, but here's some money." And I'm just like thinking to myself, "Oh my God, I can go to McDonald's for breakfast." Yeah, that's a McMuffin sandwich. That's all I thought about. And then I was thinking, "Oh my God, my fucking girlfriends are gonna blow their minds after telling the story." So of course I did, and I was revered as the most worldly person in our group, meaning I was the biggest hoe. So, so yeah, it was just insane. That day was less like I didn't even care about self-image or whatever, and thinking, I mean, you know, all I remember was he was pouring this oil over me, and I'm thinking, I'm Bo Derek from that movie Bolero. Where's the honey? Because, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with pop culture in the 80s to 70s. Bo Derek was the shit. And she became quite famous after that movie with Dudley Moore called 10, which you should watch.
Okay.
And it's amazing. And so after that, she became like the sex symbol of the early 80s. And there was this movie called Bolero. And where she was getting, you know, has a sexual relationship with this Arab prince, and Arab prince, of course, like, which developed my fetish for guys with beards. I became a pogonophile even before I knew it. He was like pouring all this oils and honey, and I was like, "My God, you know, I'm Bo Derek." Bolero. Anyways, I digress. So that was the first time I kind of conjured up all this idea about what was going on. And then, of course, the guy from Berlin, Freddie, he told me about it. He was aware of it, but the condoms keep breaking, and I didn't know back then that the condoms have expiration dates. Either that or it's too big. That's why I'm not a very fun person about anal sex, receiving it anyway. It's too painful, it's too messy, and it's a lot of effort in it. I'm a lazy lover, and so so that's how I kind of began to know. And then when I moved to Canada is when I started really getting to know more and more about it.
Mm-hmm. So in Edmonton, you were maybe learning more about it through, like,
the community? Definitely, absolutely. When especially after my diagnosis, because then they referred me to some service and an AS, from an ASO over there. And then all I remember is my counselor is like, it looks like act actor, gorgeous, and I've seen him since at some conferences because I became involved. When I moved to Kelowna, I became heavily involved with the AIDS service organization here, and then eventually working as a volunteer coordinator for about 2 years.
Oh, wow.
This is just, you know, the outline. We're skipping some things.
Of course. Yeah, no, I'll definitely want to hear a little bit about your involvement there, because I don't think we've actually heard very much about AIDS service organizations in the Okanagan, so that would be great to hear.
Really? Okay, well, they kind of, it's not as, well, first of all, the funding was cut, and they're operating in a very small office, so it's a very small budget now, I understand. So it wasn't like the 90s. Nowadays, it's really relying on AIDS Walk, and they're not, and also the Needle Exchange. Plus, they're also servicing Hep C now over here. So, and I haven't been involved in the operations of it administratively for years, but I still have contact and friends that used to be involved, and one of my friends, good friends, was an executive director, Daryl Roberts, who used to work for AIDS Vancouver, and I was part of the hiring process when we hired him on as a executive director back in the 90s, and he basically overhauled and put the AIDS service organization, well, it was called CARES back then, it was Kelowna AIDS Research and Education Services. And then we became AIDS Resource Center when Daryl Roberts came in. And then now it's called Living Positive Resource Center of the Okanagan.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still very active. So.
Mm-hmm. So you were involved there the most actively in kind of like the mid to late 90s?
Yes. Mid to early 2001.
Okay. What did that organization look like back then?
Oh, it was great. It peaked during that time because it was very active, going into schools about education. It was really pushing that agenda of education. It was the pre-internet. And we also had several projects that interacts with the community. We had the condom cops that would go to all the clubs and distribute condoms. We had a speakers bureau that, which included me, and go to schools and talk about the disease, how it's contracted, have a little in-service of how to put on a condom and what are the options of how to put on a condom using your mouth. So, you know, it was very active, and it was just full tilt education and being out there up front, not hiding, not apologizing about what we are, mm-hmm. and what our agenda was. So.
And was there a lot of support for people who are positive through that organization too?
Well, they had no choice. It was the only organization, or they would have to go to Vancouver. There was a smaller organization in Kamloops, I believe, and that's it. And that I was aware of. I think there was also Anchors. We took a lot and learned a lot from East Vancouver and PWA back then. So.
So what did that support look like? Was it just kind of like hanging out with other positive people, or?
I became actively involved because I wasn't allowed to really work with my student visa. So they gave me like an honorarium, and they felt sorry for me. And I was living then with, we're skipping this. Your story was back in Edmonton, right? About how I got diagnosed and involved. That's where I also met my first legit boyfriend, who was based here in the Okanagan in Peachland. And then after my stint at Nate fell apart, and me being in denial about my HIV and its really effect. Anyways, he asked me to move with him here in the Okanagan, which I agreed to. And then that's when I decided I was going to seek help with, or maybe volunteer my service, my free time until I figured out my immigration status. Get involved with the AIDS service organization here, and that's how I found out about CARES, and then that was it. I was involved with it, and that's the only place I felt protected and felt supported, and plus it was like the hub of knowledge of what services are being offered and what services I can access as a person who has very limited health insurance, or there's no health coverage for me. It was going to be, everything was going to be out of pocket, you know, from blood work to consultations, everything. But we had the greatest, infectious disease specialist. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of compassion and put me on some cocktails. He started me on because he was very, very well intentioned, and I got hooked up with him, with the doctor, and then he was giving me pills that were being brought back by people who either passed away or they're not going, you know, they're not doing well with the medication, and so they would stop therapy and they would give the pills back to his office. I don't know why they didn't get it to the pharmacy. Maybe back then they weren't working with pharmacies. We were just getting all our medication direct from Vancouver through Montana, through Dr. Montana. Mm. Was through BC Center of Excellence. And so back then, little did I know, I started seeing Dr. Montana as well, and who is the most amazing person in the world. Like, he should be a Nobel Prize winner. Because he's just amazing guy. I know you're aware of what he does and what he does now. I don't know. I haven't seen him in years. Because his workload must be tremendous. But yeah, so that's how I got involved and acquired more knowledge about HIV and also my health, my current health, and how I maintained it, or not maintain it, because I didn't have any coverage. I wasn't in the drug program, so the doctor, Dr. Petullo, was just scrounging to put me on these medication that should have been regular, you know what I mean, like daily. Then he could only give me certain things and then mix it up. And so what he ended up doing was increase my immunity to certain medication and complicated my situation, which ultimately put me in ICU in 2000. Oh. And back then, Dr. Petullo was already gone. He took a job in Saudi Arabia. And I almost died in 2000. And after that, I was still, my immigration things was still not, you know, fixed. And so basically, I was dealing with immigration, how to, you know, get health services. Everything was out of pocket, so I was just fortunate that by that time I had a partner who was very well off and supported me financially in everything until my immigration thing became good. Eventually we applied to change our status from student visa to landed immigrant, but apparently I have to leave the country, and that was not an option for us at the moment. And then so they said, well, you can apply under compassionate grounds and we can't recognize you as a couple, but we will have, if you say that you guys are a couple, you have to prove to us that you're a couple. So they weren't convinced that me and my boyfriend were a couple, because I was, I think I was in my 26, early, late 20s, and then my partner Darren was pushing 70. So you were not, you were, I mean, imagine in Kelowna during the 90s, we'd go into the immigration office, and there's this guy, this Asian guy with this older, much older fellow with a with silver hair, and, you know, we go there, and they'd be like, what? We could just see the expressions on their faces and what they're thinking, you know. And so we just blew their minds. They didn't know what to really say to us. But that was the option. They didn't believe us, and I was going to be deported. And then I said, well, this is the last, the last thing that maybe you should try for refugee status. But so I marched to the immigration office and demanded some immigration, some refugee application papers. And then we acquired a lawyer and immigration lawyer in Vancouver. I forgot his name now. He was even skeptical that it was going to work, because there wasn't a lot of human rights abuses towards gays and lesbians in the Philippines that he was aware of. And luckily then, I had access to an internet and contacted the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Association based in San Francisco and asked them if there was any compiled information regarding the Philippines and the LGBT. And lo and behold, there was this big package that came in from FedEx. It's this huge Bible. It's this huge compiled information, newspaper clippings. That was, you know, news items from the Philippines about the human rights abuses there, against gays and lesbians. Hmm. And back then, early 2000s, they started compiling discrimination against people with HIV and AIDS, and it was very sensationalized in Manila, and how people were responding to it, and government officials were appalled and basically blaming the victim, and those were the items that really padded the case and gave it some meat. And then I got into my immigration hearing in Vancouver, the library. The lawyer was just so, it would be a miracle that they would do this. But please, you know, lower your expectations, basically. And so there were some hard questions, and there were some questions about I was going to bring hardship to the Canadian society because, you know, I would give them who would pay for the bill, for my health bills. Well, I said, well, so far it's my partner's been paying, and he's a business owner, he pays taxes, so, you know, until I get my own coverage and be able to be to become taxable and have taxable income and contribute to society, then, and plus I've been working with ASO locally. You know, it's not like I was just sitting around in my ivory tower with an IV. You know what I mean? It's just, I've been actively contributing, and this is even before this immigration stuff. So, to make a long story short, I became a landed immigrant. They granted me my refugee status. Mm. I should have gone for get a T-shirt that says "Gay Refugee" or "Gay Refugee PWA Refugee," and so and I became a landed immigrant in 2004. Oh no, sorry. Shortly after that, and then I became a citizen in 2004.
Wow.
And then I got all my health benefits. So. Sorry, I'm winded now.
No, that's an amazing story. Wow.
And that's a lot. I know, it's dense. And that's just, you know, some of it.
Of course. And so then you were able to get onto treatment more consistently. And
yes, that's the word, consistent treatment, yeah. And now I, with the help of Dr. Montana Dr. Galemi, they said to me, you're kind of like a miracle because when you came into the ICU, we got your blood work, and you are just like zero white blood cell T cells, and there was nothing that would prevent me from dying. And so they were quite amazed how I bounced back. And now my regimen is so simple. It used to be, there's better pills now. And so now I only take like 4 pills in the morning and 2 pills at night. As compared to, having something refrigerated, you have to take it with food and this and that. And so, yeah, it's this the most streamlined therapy I've had, drug cocktail I've had since the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I've been through the gamut.
No kidding. And side effects on the cocktail now or on the meds?
No, not zero. Well, okay, the usual, which is diarrhea. And I don't even have neuropathy. I had maybe a bout of it when I was on ACT. That's how far back, ACT. And what else? I got hives because they put me on Sceptra.
Oh, yes.
And I became a bit, not addicted. I became allergic to sulfur-based drugs. So they found, I would go get hives, pop out in hives, and I thought, oh, this is just the effect. not thinking, oh, this is a side effect. And I felt, it wasn't great. So.
And then with HIV itself, did you ever really get sick, or were you kind of?
Yes, I got sick. I was in ICU in 2000.
Oh, that's right.
99. I was in the hospital in December, and then I was in ICU during just before New Year's, and it's because I started my pneumonia caught up. I got the pneumonia in 99, and then that's why. And then it became PCP because I guess all the medication I was on was the virus has become immune to them. Because they couldn't put me in something consistent. So it was just like, whatever we can grab for you. I became like this receptacle for these rejected drugs from other PWAs. So, that was the biggest health issue I had was PCP. So, But then everything became stabilized after that.
Yeah, it's very clear from your story how much your immigration status affected your access to care and support.
And distrust, back then too, I developed these horrible warts. They would start growing out at the rate that I couldn't even understand or believe. Even my general practitioner, my doctor, then was like, I was there every week, constantly having to go through the pain of getting them frozen with liquid nitrogen, and it was horrible. It might as well have a cigarette butt, seared into my skin, because basically that's the same thing. Oh. And I had warts all over my hands, and so I would wear gloves. And back then I was also DJing, so people would say, oh, you're Michael Jackson now because you're wearing gloves, black gloves in the middle of summer while DJing. And so it was just, I ran through the gamut of that. And then I didn't realize it was connected with your immune system, and because my immune system was starting to decline, the HPV virus manifested itself in these warts in my hands and also the soles of my feet. So, yeah. And then after that, when my health bounced back, they just disappeared basically like overnight.
Crazy. About CARES, was that mostly who were the types of people that were going to that organization at the time? Was it mostly gay men, or was it a wider
kind of... Mostly gay men, because it was ran mostly by gay men, and some stalwarts of professional women, and there was like maybe a token straight person, a straight guy, on the board, you know, identifying as straight. And so, we once in a while begin, but it's mostly gay people.
Mm-hmm.
That accessed it. There were some straight ones I wasn't even aware, because the coverage for CARES back then was just central Okanagan, so it was pretty wide net. And I think people then were not really ready to access it, or they don't want to, or some people don't even know they have the virus because testing was not very being pushed. Because then the idea was, well, gays only get it, you know, or marginalized people were the only ones that get it, or they don't want to know, so they don't get tested and continue to spread it, so.
And so that, like, group of folks who maybe use IV drugs, that wasn't really a big group back then?
Not that I was aware of. We were doing a lot of outreach, and once in a while we'd see somebody, a street person with a nurse help, and with a community nurse, from outreach that would come in with so-and-so client. So I was working the reception desk as well, so I see a lot of people. But the people that ask is mostly gays, and very few straight people or I don't know whether they're straight or not, but I know the gay people that I know because they run the socials back then. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you want to say anything about how the medical kind of response to the epidemic, how that looked from your perspective here?
I think they were supportive. They were funding wise, anyway. But there was also great skepticism about our competency. Daryl Roberts' competency was, of course, questioned very aggressively. And they were wondering, oh, where's money going? Why do they have these fancy offices? Blah, 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 and all this stuff. And then, but the evidence is there. I mean, everything was... we had records of everything that who goes out of that office for outreach, what happened, what was the result. Everything was quantitative, and we have evidence for it. We went through some scandals too, so that didn't help with the reputation of CARES back then. There were some scandals. We had board president of the board was embezzling some money from the job, and then we also had a treasurer who embezzled some money from CARES. So there was these two incidents that kind of put a blight on the reputation of the AIDS Service Organization at that time. There was some drama, so major drama that happened. And so, otherwise, I think they were fair, but they really scrutinized Daryl and the operation and where the money is going. We get audited every year. But the programs were effective. And if anything, there was people were talking about it more. There was that AIDS walk. The AIDS walk was tremendous. So every year, it just grew and grew and grew and grew. So even within the community and also the public opinion.
Mm.
So it really raised the bar with regards to AIDS service organizations here within the interior. So comparably, people are from smaller towns, even Kamloops and Verna, they would look up to the ones here in Kelowna and look at the business models, programs, and whatever else. And so they always referred here, even the volunteer program that I ran. So.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, how was mainstream society responding to HIV back in those days, back in the 90s?
It was typical. It was typical. The 90s were the dark ages. We call it the dark ages. It was a lot of opinion in the paper. There was a lot of letter writing and letters to the editor and expressing. Because back then, the internet wasn't really out there as a place for public forum, but there was it wasn't like it was a totally different time, and everything seemed primitive now compared to back then. We thought we were but there was a lot of effort, a lot of effort thwarting myths about HIV, Hep C, and how it's contracted. And thank God for the Speakers Bureau program, because we had to fight and prove ourselves to the school board that what we're bringing into the schools is that we're arming these people that are filled with hormones and blood, and so they're easily excitable. So we are trying to arm them with information that could save them having to contract HIV.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a reluctant support, but now it's like information is everywhere, and if you contract HIV, then I hate to say it to you, but okay, you might have done it accidentally, but ultimately it's up to you to be responsible for your own sexual health and your own health in general. Never leave it to another person. Never, blame another person for your being contracted. How about maybe you just disregarded the information that's available to you for whatever reason you have personally? But I don't know, some people still have this stereotype and stigma. And so they're operating and run. Even nowadays, I run into people who have no idea about how it gets contracted. They have the most stupidest ideas on how it's contracted. And I said, it's easier for you to catch Hep C and the herpes virus compared to HIV. Mm-hmm. So it's really, and if you're going to expose yourself. Not that I'm judging, I'm very sex positive, and I said, okay, you're going to go to a group situation, you're going to go to a sex party, and then you want to be a cum receptacle for everybody. Well, and then you don't practice, you don't know, or you don't want to know, and you don't take PrEP, and what do you expect? That you're going to go be unscathed? Well, maybe if you were lucky, maybe. But, generally, if you become a cum receptacle for 50 guys in one weekend, what do you expect? So when people come to me, I give them the cold truths. It's like, honey, you got to just look at it this way. Why are you putting on other people? Mm. Your safety. and that's what people in Grindr are clean only, safe only. Define safe behavior, please. So yeah, that's what I'm dealing with right now.
Yeah.
Within this age, you should be. I don't know. People are dumb. I have the right and I've earned to say that, because I mean, back then I contracted this in 88, 89, and I was dumb. So,
but there's a lot more information out there now than there was back then.
Absolutely, they can access anything. I mean, if they can access felching videos without ID. If a high school guy, 19-year-old, could watch felch videos all day, sniffing poppers, I mean, what the fuck? You know what I mean?
Yes.
You can call me on that.
Yes, yeah, we might.
Oh my god. So yeah, I mean, if you can access all that information there, you There is no excuse, girl. So.
Well, speaking of stigma, how prevalent was that within the gay community back in the 90s?
Oh my God, seriously? You are instantly a pariah if you come out as positive. I mean, when we were in university and we were running this booth, people from the social, from the, you know, what do you call it? Social service program would come up and like, oh, do you have AIDS? Girl, this is your classmate. She's volunteering and you are accusing her of having AIDS. You know, I'm like, what? Just because you're volunteering for the volunteering at the booth, you have AIDS or you're gay? I mean, yeah, that was the mentality back then. Wow. And, you know, this is Kelowna. It's like in Bible Belt. So they have all these stupid, twisted ideas about it. And the stigma was just further inflamed by all these weird ideas. So, mm-hmm. Plus we hear all these people dying, right? And becoming horrible. I mean, everybody's health. When they have health problems, people with cancer, they become looking like cadavers, you know, even before they die. So it's the same. But it's the same, but it's different because AIDS has a more, like, oh, you know, the God's punishing you. Cancer is different, you know. So the cancer has a different brand, and it's a different, you know, people have a different idea about cancer. So sometimes people would die of AIDS complications. They would say they died of cancer.
Just because the stigma is so bad.
Yes, exactly. I buried a friend whose mother had no idea he died from AIDS complications.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, certainly the death of so many young men is a big part of this this story, too, if you were part of the gay community.
Yep.
Just looking at some other questions here. Did you get involved in any kind of forms of activism around HIV? I mean, I guess going into schools and stuff, that's kind of a form of that.
Yeah, exactly. That's our form of activism, was me getting involved with AIDS Research Center. Being able to facilitate that, facilitating like a group, support group. Not sex party group, but you know, it's just being able for people to come into a place and they feel safe and sharing and talking and exchanging and numbers and so and ideas. So I guess you can say that. Well, I attended a World AIDS conference, there was a lot of ideas, and I joined some groups that had some picketing going on. It was a lot of activity back then. So whether I categorize as an activist, I think the fact that I was involved in it was my, you know, even administratively, was it in itself, was activism. And having to go to the mayor's office and us getting World AIDS Day, proclaimed, but in the same week, getting our Pride Week questioned for the proclamation, and that's when we ended up suing the mayor. We sued the mayor for taking the pride from the proclamation. I'm sure, I don't know if you've heard about it, but we were pretty controversial back then.
Wow.
He sued the mayor for human rights, slapped him with a human rights, I forget the word. But anyways, we put Kelowna in national news for our nerve to do that.
When was that?
Early 2000s.
Okay.
You have to Google it.
I will.
It was quite. Yeah, and then the funny thing was, it came for a full circle 3 years ago now. Mayor Walter Gray reelected as a mayor, but this time around he was kissing the gays and joining the pride and proclaiming it Kelowna Pride Week and all that. It was amazing. It just came full circle because it's just young. He probably had no idea that he was going to be a marshal for. For the Pride Day, as a celebration, and kissing a drag queen right on stage. So it was amazing. So, yeah. Cologne is quite the town, so very storied.
Yeah, I'm also just curious about what the gay community looked like back then in Kelowna, because we haven't talked about many people. Yeah.
We were in caves. to get a man with. Beat them up and then drag them into the cave. No, I'm just kidding. It was any other small place. And they were all, it was very hush-hush, you know, everything was, there was a lot of shame, guilt, self-hatred, which still happens, but it's not as intense back then. The kids nowadays, I mean, you can walk around downtown Kelowna and be in full drag and full face and get, you know, hey, girl, it's amazing. It was like Davy in the 90s, Davy Street in the 90s. And now it's like people don't even blink. You know, a girl walking around with a Sinead O'Connor haircut and kissing her girlfriend right there. It was just nothing. Mm. Although we still get, once in a while, we get, you know, these, you know, the bashes and this and that, but that's part of it. You can never have good without the bad. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely way more good now. Social climate has just, it's amazing now. I fell in love in COVID Kelowna again, so.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, that is amazing how different it is compared to a couple decades ago.
Uh-huh, exactly. God, decades.
Wow, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's true. and so then nobody would be like out as HIV positive at the time in Kelowna, I guess.
Oh no, yeah, it's very, very few. I wasn't back then. I was really, when I was trying to hook up, none of that came up. Mind you, I only do oral, so. And so, you know, and also, since I was undetectable, I wasn't upfront with it. And it was just, again, it was just like oral. Mm-hmm. And I never brushed my teeth if I knew I had a date. Mm-hmm. So it was, yeah, I was very cautious about, and there's a word for it. But anyways, I was very careful, making sure that I don't. Infect anybody, and also if it put a toll in my own would have, you know, facing myself in the mirror, like, can you continue doing this? Because there's this guilt, there's this you know. And then finally I came out full out on Grindr. It says positive undetectable, so of course nobody talks to me now. I'm a social pariah again. So,
is that
whatever?
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's still the.
Well, you know, it's just the way it is. Yet, you know, they will watch Treasure Island Media videos all night while, you know, their wife's cooking in the next room. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, some things never change.
Yeah, but I mean, I would hope that message around undetectability is actually getting out there to people.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes people, you know how people are, they were like, positive and detectable, what does that mean? And it doesn't matter. You have the virus, you have the virus. They don't care whether you're undetectable or not, you know? Really, they don't.
I mean, they should.
Ultimately.
They should.
Some people do. They should. But, and also, there's some people that are educated about it. And I think the younger people, young people, millennials under 25, have a more real grasp of what undetectable means, because they see it a lot now. And this is the older ones, who are very ageists, for one thing. You know, and they put people back into the closet, and having these requirements about being clean, the wording of clean and what it connotes, and what else? Yeah, or if you're over 30, you might as well be dead. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I remember putting up this on Facebook. There was this news item about the world's oldest living creature, which is this tortoise, male tortoise, is gay. So I said, so in human years, this means this poor turtle is 30. So I got a lot of likes on that one.
Yes, my partner just turned 30, and one of our gay friends joked that he's entered the gay death years. So
yeah, exactly. I mean, and then there's so many biases and ill-informed negativity. So yeah.
So the stigma is still out there. How has your perception of what HIV means changed, since the 80s and 90s to the present? How's that changed?
Well, I have a different opinion of myself now. And the fact that despite the abuse that I put my body through, I mean, I went through the Muscle Mary stages, because I was at one point going to New York City a lot. I was dating somebody in Brooklyn. And so I had to have the look. And so until I almost had kidney failure, because I was overdoing all the roids and the hormones. And then I have a different opinion about myself now, and definitely a positive one, for lack of, no pun intended, but yeah. You know what I mean, like, I have a different, like, I'm dirty, I'm an AIDS infected hoe bag, you know. It's nothing like that no more. It's more like, yeah, I'm undetectable. This time got away with murdering myself, almost. So
what led to that change? That change in your kind of self-perception?
Well, more better information about the, you know, the latest news about what being undetectable means, and this and that, and the guilt has been lifted, because all my blood, I'm always trying to get my blood work as recent as I can, and it's always been undetectable, which is really crazy to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, after having it contracted it in the 80s, and I'm still undetectable and can still pass as 30, despite I'm pushing 50, so.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Asians don't crack.
So. That's amazing on both fronts, for sure.
Well, full disclosure, I had a chemical peel when I was 40. It's a Botox, but still.
I'll keep that in mind as I age a little bit, as a backup plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, chemical peels are good. Avoid the sun.
Yes. And how do you think the epidemic changed the gay community, whether that's in Kelowna or Edmonton or any of the other communities that you might have been a part of?
Well, I can't say much about the other places, but I can say, well, here, very minimal that I'm aware of, just with the use of the app, right? Grindr was without my status showing. People are just ready to talk. And then you put positive undetectable, suddenly nothing. Maybe one or two here. And I even got one track that goes, "Wow, you're positive, blah, blah, blah." And, you know, and then I sent him all the documentation of the, just to cover my ass legally. And I was like, here you go. Here's the information. So, not liable, bitch. Surprise.
Do you see Do you see prep on people's profiles there?
Yes, I see that a lot. And I see that even before prep was approved here, which is a total bullshit. Because I said, well, how are you accessing it? Oh, I have a connection to States. Really? Do you even know what the fuck Truvada means, bitch? So, you know, I was very skeptical. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm.
And because, you know, let's call, I mean, let's face it. I mean, the porn that people watch affects how they want to do their, you know, how they act in their sex lives. I'm not blaming, okay, I'm not going to blame porn, but the fact that it's just so readily accessible, it affects our brains. And when that's our fantasy, and that's where, we want to live that fantasy, you know, to quote Bianca. And I would be like, if I was a young person nowadays, and I see all this Treasure Island media, you know, and all this group thing, and that's like normal. So they would just put negative prep there and just say, oh, you know, then they can just, you know, engage in all this high-risk behavior, so.
Hmm.
So that's the thing. But, of course, I'm very pessimistic because I'm an old gay. And but in the same way, all, you know, however, I will still say that it's way better now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's more. It facilitates coming out, you know, for people. And there, back when we were in back then, there was really no option but to keep it in the down low.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Hmm. Well, we've talked about the young whippersnappers out there in the community a little bit. Do you have any advice for younger gay folks out there
who didn't, don't do math.
Who didn't live
don't
through
slam
this.
It, don't inhale it, didn't start it. So, yeah, that's number one. Although I'm not judging, because I had 19-year-old come over, but I said to them, don't expect sex. You will have a warm bed to sleep on, because I know you're homeless, or you're sleeping in your car, whatever reason. Don't expect sex, but you will get not a lecture, but a bunch of stories.
Mm.
So, yeah. I know, that's a true story. I spoke to two 19-year-olds, and they were telling me that already they tried meth. At first, they said, oh, I thought it was crack. And I... There's two different types of pipes for those things. Meth has a bubble at the end. The other one is just like a Bic, like a pen, you know. But so how could you mistake it? But I don't know. I just say to them, I don't judge you for doing these things. But I will say that it's a very slippery slope. And once you're, when you're in the thick of it, sometimes it's hard to get out.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it's hard to get out. So that's the cold, hard truths. Enjoy when you can, but please be responsible for your own health. Don't ever blame anybody, because blaming anybody will not solve any problems. It will just burn bridges.
Hmm. Yeah, we know that the substance use numbers within the community today are pretty high, so it's certainly something to be aware of.
I know, because you know, I go to a dinner party with, you know, gay professionals around the table, and the dessert is this pipe. It's a bong for meth pipes. I mean, in this posh house up in the hills. And that's, you know, I'm like, well, what can I say? So, you know, it really, it's insidious. I shouldn't say negative things, because people will do what they want to do. They want to explore whatever their philosophical beliefs are regarding life. They want to be empiricists. They want to experience everything before they can make an opinion about everything. Well, that was me. And so, you know, people should be responsible for their own sexual health is basically what I want to say out there. Never blame anybody else for infecting you if you, you know, you've contracted. Mm-hmm. Anything. It doesn't have to be HIV. So ultimately, we are responsible for our own health and state of being.
I think that's a good message to pass along, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And then that also deals with the stigma, because if you're responsible for your own health, then you can't, you know, people are hard pressed to deprecate themselves, especially, you know, in this age of self-image and Instagram and all this stuff. But deep down, they're still rotten. They know they're rotten inside. What I'm saying is that when there's more responsibilities, if you have that answer to yourself, then people will maybe have a more better understanding and more empathy.
Hmm.
Maybe empathy will come out of it, you know, towards people who are positive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Any other thoughts on where you got support from, I guess, after your diagnosis, besides from CARES? Were there any other major sources for you?
Well, PWA, East Vancouver, you know, Friends for Life. That's it. I'm just so busy. Sometimes I didn't know that I was accessing, but the fact that you're getting involved, you've accessed the service. Because, you know, it gives you a different opinion about yourself and the self-discovery, and you have a better knowledge and grasp of who you are and what your abilities are as a human being towards how you view other people, the empathy and, you know, compassion that stems out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, if that answered your question, I don't know, but that's what I want to say. Mm-hmm. Anyways, we're almost, I'm late for, well, not late, I told my appointment that I will be in about 2:30.
Okay.
So I should... if we can... Is there more questions? Like, maybe skip the
no, that, ones? No, that's kind of most of the stuff that I wanted to ask. We always do like to leave like a little bit of space at the end just to see if there's anything that you want to touch on that we didn't cover.
I think that's pretty much it. Is what my the gist of my experience is that, you know, I mean, I was an asshole before, and now I'm an older and less less. I mean, I'm a curmudgeon still, but an old curmudgeon, you know. But also, I have more compassion and more. I empathize with people and having the privilege of having a wealthy boyfriend back in the day, maybe an asshole, and then also having all this self-hatred. But now I'm kind of 50, pushing on 50, going on 27, because basically, you know, my codependency issues are, you know, ridiculous. But this is the longest time I've been single, and, you know, I kind of wanted to be single because there's a lot of things that I should have learned as a human being living with this virus that I should have learned in my 20s or early 30s as opposed to pushing 50s. Don't do drugs when you're 40, especially when you've never tried drugs. Although because of my empiricist ideals, I thought I should try what these gays are doing at when I turn 40. What am I missing? What's a circuit party? What is this? And so, that's my thing. So have more compassion and empathy towards people, because just because they have that health problem, you don't know their life. So, you know. But you can't tell these things to people. They have to know it, learn it by themselves, and discover it. You can put all that message and information out there as much as you want to lower stigma or maybe a race stigma, but it will never be a race. People will always have these antiquated, ill-informed ideas about it. But it's just up to us to how to deal with that. And you can self-destruct, which is the easier way, or make yourself valuable and help out in erasing that stigma. You know, I mean, I guess I could go back to the gym and kill myself and, and become a messy queen. No, I don't want to be, but I can certainly, when this opportunity came about, I saw, I don't even remember how I, did I email you or did I apply? I don't even remember. Oh yeah, I got a card. Where did I get it? I don't even remember now, but I saw the number and on the email, and I thought I'd email and, you know, partake in this study. So,
yeah, well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I think you've kind of shared a perspective that's a little bit different than a lot of the other ones that we've captured so far.
Yeah, mine pales in comparison because there's a lot of stupid comedic moments. I mean, you know, I see things differently, and now that, of course, when I was younger, as I've told you before, I was an asshole, major asshole back then, but I'm, you know, I'm just me. I can live minimalistically, which also translates to I'm poor, and so I'm okay now with myself. I'm more comfortable with my own skin, and having become out as a positive and detectable individual. So
great. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this with me. Unless you have anything else to add, I'll just stop the recording.
Okay, no, nothing else to add. I'm just glad I managed to to tell you that. And that's that. So hopefully you'll make sense or use of it. As I told you, I ramble.
No, this is actually, like, you know, fairly concise in the grand scheme of things. So, no, not too bad at all. Okay, I'm just stopping this.